for 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on August 12, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate join me to talk about radicalism in New Mexico and Arizona. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
How's it going, Bill?
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
We're going to be talking about a few historical elements from New Mexico and Arizona this week, continuing our regional tour of the United States and various sort of radical histories. There's plenty of history you could talk about with regard to these states that doesn't necessarily fall under the radicalism category, but we found three particular things, history and modern day, that we wanted to talk about in these two states. The first one that I wanted to talk about was the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, also known as Pope's Rebellion. This was under the Spanish period. So basically, this was in the province of New Mexico or Santa Fe de Nuevo Mexico. It was under the Spanish Empire's control, and they had been trying to sort of semi-leaning toward pretty heavily forcibly convert the population, the indigenous population, to Catholicism and kind of integrate them into their society, but also, you know, were enslaving them and that sort of thing. The Spanish presence had heavily arrived about a century earlier in like 1580s, 1590s. But by 1680, there had been a period of several years of pretty sustained violence by the colonial administration against the local indigenous population, as well as some pretty significant droughts, and the crops were failing. Now, the Pueblo people, this refers broadly to a category of indigenous populations in what is now sort of a lot of it's heavily in northeastern Arizona, but would have then been part of all the same, you know, New Mexico province, which also would have extended up into modern day Colorado. But they, you know, there are several different groups. They were referred to as, by the Spanish, as Pueblo because they lived in those distinctive villages with the sort of adobe, the mud wall apartments, the really, you know, rectangular squared off buildings, sometimes a couple stories. And they had moved, you know, migrated several centuries earlier out of the cliff dwellings, often referred to as Anasazi, although that's generally now considered to be an offensive term because it's actually from the Navajo word for ancient enemies. And so it's not their own term for themselves. But those people had used to live, you know, hundreds of years earlier in the cliffs, but then, had, you know, by the time the Spanish arrived, were living in these villages. So then they were called Pueblos. But by 1680 in this area, there was just a lot of like discontent. But the problem is they hadn't really coordinated with each other to resist Spanish rule because there were so many different groups within the overall category referred to as Pueblo who had very little in common with each other other than living in this agricultural lifestyle that stayed in one place. And, you know, the farming culture was very important culturally, and they lived in these sort of apartment buildings that they had constructed. There's actually, I looked this up, there's four distinct language families, not even just distinct languages, but four distinct language families that have nothing in common with each other, which made it so that they really couldn't talk to each other very easily. Like, you'd have to have someone who understood the other language families in order to communicate. So this guy, Pope, used two things to try to coordinate an uprising. Basically, one thing that he did was utilized Spanish language because that was sort of a common language, lingua franca, in the area at that point. You know, if they didn't speak the same indigenous languages after a century of colonial rule, they at least understood Spanish enough to be able to communicate with each other. So they were using the tools they had been given by the oppressors to try to coordinate this uprising. And then the other thing that he did was he sent out runners to all the different communities after they had agreed upon a strategy to rise up, and gave them these knotted ropes, and it had a knot for each day until the day they were supposed to rise up from their various locations. And they were all supposed to rise up on a given specific day so they could mobilize very quickly all at once for across a huge area. And they were supposed to untie one knot each day so they would all coordinate it. Now, this plan almost worked because they were going along getting pretty close to the day, but unfortunately two of the runners were captured right near the end, and so he tried to move up the timetable of the uprising at the last second because the plan was compromised. And unfortunately some of the communities, the villages, did not get the message in time, and they went on the day they were supposed to rise up instead of earlier, et cetera, et cetera. And so some of the, you know, basically the result of this was that instead of there being this, you know, huge protracted siege at the provincial capital, which I think was Santa Fe at the time. I'm reading a lot of this, by the way, from the NewMexicoHistory.org website, article by Robert Torres, the former New Mexico state historian. And we'll have links at Arsenal for Democracy for all of this. But they instead of this being this, like, you know, a bunch of people getting wiped out immediately on the colonial side, and then there being a, you know, a siege that was hard to get out of. There were some massacres, but basically the Spanish were able to withdraw from the two largest communities, and they met up with each other and then continued their retreat. And so they actually did leave. So the uprising, the revolt in 1680 was initially successful, and in a way that many similar uprisings kind of failed or fizzled out almost immediately. But even though it didn't go quite as planned, they withdrew about 300 some odd miles, I think more than that, to El Paso, which today is in Texas, and just abandoned the entire province for about 12 years. And so in that metric, it was definitely a huge victory for the indigenous population there. Unfortunately, the problems that had prevented them from uniting in the first place for many years basically were still problems after the uprising succeeded, which is that you had a whole bunch of like a dozen or close to a dozen different indigenous communities who had huge cultural differences in addition to language differences. Like some of them were organized along matrilineal systems, and some of them were organized along patrilineal systems. And, you know, like that's just sort of like one element. And then from there, you know, all these differences sort of multiply and magnify, and they still didn't speak the same language as each other. The other thing is that, you know, he had kind of portrayed himself as this almost messianic figure, where, you know, if you all unite behind me, we're going to restore the traditional religious systems, you know, and stamp out Catholicism and get rid of all the colonial traces, and that's going to bring back the rains, the drought's going to end, and we're all going to be fine. Unfortunately, the drought continued, and there also wasn't complete agreement among these communities over, you know, what exactly they were restoring, because they didn't have a unified culture. And, you know, some of them were maybe a little bit more willing to have certain Spanish elements in their culture or religious elements. And so there was disagreement internally on that front. And, you know, it was hard to keep it together. And the longer the drought persisted, it became very clear that he was not going to be able to deliver on this, and that the religious restoration was not working as intended. So I think he didn't even make it that long past this, I think maybe a year or so. And then he was basically executed, I guess. And they still maintained local control and indigenous control for about 12 years. But then the Spanish, you know, empire gathered together a force to march northward. And it wasn't even a particularly large one. They didn't send like a huge army to restore control. It became clear to them that the sort of Pueblo alliance had fallen apart and was not going to be able to mount a particularly effective resistance. So they just went north and said, okay, who's ready to sign a peace deal? And pretty much everyone was at that point. You know, and I'm sure they were also probably offering like food aid or something like that to try to, you know, incentivize them to come to the table. And so then, you know, in the 1690s, Spanish control was restored. Several centuries later, there was a much smaller uprising that was not as successful. The Taos Revolt of 1847, which was a combined revolt by the Pueblo people and some Hispanic people. At that point, you know, after the Mexican Revolution in the early 1800s, there had been this, there had been various attempts to try to make, you know, a more like less class hierarchy, less racial hierarchy in Mexico Central. And that had mixed success, didn't really work so well. But in the New Mexico province, there was a very strict racial hierarchy that was much stricter than a lot of areas of Mexico. And so at that point, as the Mexican administration was leaving during the Mexican-American War, they basically surrendered without a fight in New Mexico. The U.S. occupation began, military occupation, and a bunch of the sort of people who were lower on the rankings of Hispanic people, along with the absolute lowest rung, which was the Pueblo people in places like Taos, they banded together and decided to stage an insurrection against the U.S. military occupation. It was pretty bloody, and initially had like maybe a couple days of success, but then the U.S. military, which had gone off to do other stuff, basically showed up again in force and brought artillery and cornered everyone in a church and then blew a hole in the church and then started firing the cannon inside. And so like a lot of people died in that one, and it was pretty quick to surrender after that. So not as successful, but it was the same general location. The Taos Pueblo had been instrumental in the uprising in 1680, in that mostly focused on the Santa Fe area, but this time Taos itself rose up. So that was just an interesting history. And today, since the year 2005, Popeye has been one of two statues from New Mexico that are in the U.S. Capitol, which I thought was pretty interesting. Each state gets two statues, so there's 100 statues representing the different states, just like there's 100 senators. And one of the statues from New Mexico is this guy who coordinated this unprecedented uprising that did succeed for about a dozen years in the New Mexico province of the Spanish Empire. Jumping forward in history quite a bit, Nate, you wanted to talk about the Empire Zinc Strike in New Mexico. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Empire Zinc Strike was a 15-month-long strike by the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers. This was 1950, and so there was about 8 months of striking based on demands for, say, indoor plumbing and hot water for Mexican-American miners who'd often been living in segregated houses and were not obviously given the same provisions as the white workers there. And so that was a big sort of impetus for the strike. There were sort of strike breakers brought in to harass the picketers. They tried to evict some people. They tried to cut off credit at the company store. And this is all in New Mexico, so sort of near Silver City, the company town there for the Empire Zinc Company.
And this was in the very early 1950s, right? Like 1950, 51.
52. Yeah. And so for the first 8 months, the men were striking, but then there was a court injunction through possibly the Taft-Hartley Act, and they forbid the male picketers, the miners technically, from returning to the picket lines, but then their wives and children and other women from around the area who were in solidarity with them continued picketing for another, I think, like another 7 months. And eventually, because, you know, the police could not quite harass and imprison the women the same way that they could to the men, eventually there was another anti-picketing injunction, and it drew unfavorable attention, and eventually they had to sit down and basically give the strikers everything they wanted. This is by the early 52, so it improved wages and benefits and provided hot water to homes in the town. And so a pretty successful strike overall. Labor activist Clinton Jenks, who was the union's business agent when the strike was organized, had been imprisoned and kept in solitary confinement for 16 months, so about the length of the strike. There was that as well. And what I thought was interesting about this sort of strike was there was actually a film about it produced quickly after called Salt of the Earth, which actually I just watched. It's available on YouTube because it's now in the public domain, I believe. But this film was actually blacklisted for the alleged communist involvement of some of the members of the production team. Directed by Herbert Biberman, written by Michael Wilson, and produced by Paul Jericho, So they had all been blacklisted, including some of the Hollywood 10. And the film was itself blacklisted in the United States. Apparently it was like ran in one theater for like 10 days. But it's been brought back, I think, in the 90s to the National Film Registry because of the historical significance. And I definitely recommend people watch it, check it out, especially, you know, these days where there's all the hype around Sorry to Bother You, taking on these very union themes. So just a couple tidbits from the movie. I thought it was interesting. It was in many ways a very feminist film. The main character is the woman who's sort of the wife of one of the people organizing the strike, and then she takes on her own leadership, despite the husband at times sort of being unfamiliar with this. But there were all sorts of sort of interesting tidbits in there about how sort of people coming together and unionizing, and there are lines like showing how the whites are being sort of weaponized against Mexicans in terms of their wages, like, oh, at least you're getting more than the Mexicans. At one point, I thought it was interesting when they're on strike, they're being told to go back where you came from. And one guy like says, look, I was born on the, in a shack like up the road here on this on this company town. Like, why were you? There's been no managers born out here in New Mexico. So, you know, there was that. There was also interesting scene where there like a lot of the Mexican and some of the white workers are playing cards at someone's home, and basically people the white sort of the white union organizer, I think he may have been assaulting going around organizing at different plants, but he was sort of called out for not knowing who Juarez, very famous Mexican leader. He asked like, oh, is this your grandfather? And then so instead of sort of backing himself into a corner, he sort of admits like, no, I need to learn more about you know, sort of the culture of the Mexican workers. And, you know, he's trying to be an ally, but at the same time admits that, you know, he has a lot to learn. The wives are also calling out their husbands for sort of being, you know, overprotective and having these patriarchal roles that, you know, they expect the women to play, but the women are very much taking charge, going out first, just bringing like, say, coffee to the strikers, and then eventually going out there and striking themselves. One woman is hit by a car. And eventually all the women are locked up and they're in jail chanting to be let out, and including babies are also thrown in jail. And then eventually the sort of mass movement and solidarity from other women in the area, they come in and have a large picket line there. So eventually things get settled out, and the, you know, the bosses basically can't take it anymore. So they're forced to settle. And, overall, I'd say a pretty interesting movie, just in terms of showing the sort of solidarity there and showing, how this type of film was even made back in the 50s, and it had to be suppressed because it was potentially a little more too radical, or things got a little too real in there. Even found a, interview with, Noam Chomsky from like the 90s, where he's talking about how, the film was suppressed, and it was basically never shown. And this, it came out at the same time as On the Waterfront, which has a anti-union message. So they sort of had to suppress one and then sort of put the other up as a sort of example of like, oh, this is why unions are bad. And this is, of course, you know, the 50s, Red Scare, everything involved there. So definitely interesting sort of strike history there, and a nice piece of film if people can check out. I think it's available on YouTube. So, yeah.
All right. And our final thing that we wanted to talk about is something that's been going on for probably, I think, maybe at least the last 10 years now at this point, if I'm remembering correctly. It's about the present day struggle that shouldn't even probably be that radical, but I guess it is. Struggle for ethnic studies in the Arizona public education system. And Rachel's going to talk about that.
It's almost been 10 years, but it's about 8 years. So on May 11th, 2010, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, who is infamous for wagging her finger in Obama's face in a pretty famous picture, she signed House Bill 2281, which prohibits a school district or charter school from including in its program of instruction any courses that promotes the overthrow of the federal or state government or the Constitution, promotes resentment toward any race or class, advocates ethnic solidarity instead of being individuals, and are designed for a certain ethnicity. So this was kind of pointed at the Mexican American Studies program in the Tucson Unified School District. There was a superintendent of public instruction, Tom Horn. He kind of spearheaded this, and then he later went on to become state attorney general, and he publicly campaigned on what would become HB 2281. So this was kind of in response to veteran Latinx labor organizer Dolores Huerta, who said that Republicans hate Latinos in a speech to Tucson high school students. So that's kind of the impetus that started this bill. The one thing that really sticks out to me is point number three. It is against ethnic solidarity instead of the treatment of pupils as individuals. So they're directly targeting minority groups coming together, learning their history, learning about the struggles they've had against the racial majority or like the class majority in Arizona. So I think that is definitely the part of the bill that enraged a lot of activists and organizers. So there's been a lawsuit that got settled in August of 2017. And the judge said that it was unfair, unconstitutional. It violated the First Amendment because it was the government suppressing a viewpoint, and the 14th Amendment for void for vagueness rights. So this appeal was filed in October 2010, and it took until August of 2017 to make it through the courts and kind of go through all its various appeals. I think it's still on appeal, actually, but there was an injunction filed against this bill in December of 2017. So they currently cannot enforce this bill, and so they can't use the threat of taking education funding away from schools for teaching ethnic studies in these schools.
This applies to multiple levels of education, or is it just the like K through 12, or is it higher ed, or is it both?
I think it's mainly targeting K through 12 education. I don't know.
I thought it was also affecting the ethnic studies departments at like Arizona State and so forth, which Arizona State University is one of the largest public universities in the country in terms of number of students, 72,000 students.
The law just prohibits a school district or charter school from including a program of instruction. So I'm guessing it did affect post-secondary education as well. So it affected the education for thousands of students. Something that was interesting to note is the bill did not ban African-American studies courses that were also being taught. So this was definitely a direct attack on Mexican-American studies. So very clear that it was unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds. So it'll be interesting to see if, I know they're trying to appeal it again, so it'll be interesting to see if it goes anywhere from here. As of December 2017, these schools are free to teach Mexican-American studies in their schools. So I think it is definitely a victory for First Amendment rights and for ethnic solidarity, exactly what the state is kind of fighting against. By learning about these victories, so like the mine strikes, the Taos revolt, where Mexicans and Native populations came together, as we learned today, I think this is a very important piece of history and goes back centuries.
I like this quote from him. It says, "I'm an immigrant myself." He said, "Horn is from Montreal, but has lived in Arizona since the 1970s. And I'm also thinking, like, this is the equivalent of saying, like, we can't teach about, like, the French-Canadian history or something of Montreal. Like, this is the exact same thing. So this would not fly up in Montreal, I'm pretty sure. So I'm just saying.
Yeah, I guess that is a pretty good comparison, especially given that guy's background. And you know, yeah, as you're alluding to here, like the ethnic composition of Arizona is such that it's just frankly absurd to be like, oh, you're not allowed to teach this history.
Oh yeah, there's a tidbit here. In the 2015-2016 school year, in the Tucson United School District, Latinx students made up 63.7% of the student population. So it's actually really insulting to cater a curriculum towards white history and the history of the white people in Arizona when that is such a tiny part of the history of the state, and there's centuries of Latinx history in that state. So it's just insulting to try to suppress that.
Yeah, I
in
think
the state.
I think part of it is just the anxiety as the student force becomes more and more non-white. They have to sort of shift into this and like, oh, it's actually racist to talk about ethnic solidarity. Got him.
Yeah, and there's a study that says that this program was very successful. 98% of Mexican American studies students reported they did homework, and 66% went on to college. So the program was widely regarded as helping Latino youth feel empowered and to achieve their full academic and human potential. So if you're seeing history that reflects you, it's much more inspiring than getting taught a bunch of history that has nothing to do with you and is kind of purporting the greatness of white Americans.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us today. So, Rachel, thanks for being on the line with us this week.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.